How do I know one of you is not infected? That this is not the Rider's plan?
It's not, believe me. This plan is so bad, it has to be ours.
Okay.
Hello and welcome to the Frollcast. I'm Erin.
I'm Monica.
And we are the Farscape Friends, talking this week about episode 309, Losing Time. Written by Justin Monjo, that guy.
Really?
The Monj. Yeah, the Monj wrote this one. And directed by Catherine Millar, who you will remember from My Three Crichtons and LGM Part 2.
Okay.
Yeah, I think this is the last episode that she directs.
I'm surprised that the Monj wrote this one, because I did not find it as compelling as a Monjo episode usually is.
It is as funny as a Monjo episode usually is, though.
Yes, there are definitely some nice moments and some things that made me laugh, but the overall skeleton of the plot makes me unhappy as a person.
Mm. I mean, I guess he's come to be like the John Aaron shipper writer, and if Aaron's not there, gotta focus on some other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, here we are.
Here we are.
Here we are, losing some time. We're on Moya.
Yes.
We're on Moya, and we're on Scorpius's ship, which is interesting and unusual.
Yeah.
I have always had, like, a weird affection for this episode, and I'm not sure why.
Okay.
I'm not sure if we'll get to the bottom of it in this podcast, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. Let's go ahead and start with the promo.
Next Friday on an all-new episode of Farscape.
For one of you, judgment starts now.
Are you saying there's a diseased alien in one of us?
We get the demon out, we kill it, and pilot lives.
It's now time to proceed with biological trials.
This ride stays too long and diseases minds, gives only desire and despair.
Farscape.
Kind of a weird mishmash of stuff, that one.
Yeah, my biggest impression is something that cannot be heard, only seen, which is that they feature, like, one of the shots of Chiana when she's infected with John, and their faces are really close, and they're very like, oh, look, they're gonna do a makeout!
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, really, promo people? Okay, that is a choice
yeah.
that you can make.
Interestingly, when I was reading last week's forum posts, when this promo aired, people were like, oh, they're going to put Moya John with Chiana. Like, that was the theory that they were operating on, is they were going to set those up as a couple. Which was strange. There's also a lot of Scorpius in this promo, but it's interesting because I can't tell if the promo is trying to make the Moya plot and the Scorpius plot seem related, because they are not related in the episode.
Yeah, that was sort of the impression that I got, is that, yeah. So, little misleading there. A little bit of false advertising.
Yeah. So, I think there are a few misdirects that this episode is built on. So, I guess in that sense, the promo is appropriate. Would you like to give us the rundown?
Yes, I would love to give
Monica's
us run a rundown.
Run it down.
Okay, I'm going to run it down. So, on Moya, they're looking at a wormhole, or they're near a wormhole, John thinks, and so everybody's really annoyed with him. And then in the course of this, they pass through an electromagnetic cluster, which brings two energy riders onto the ship, and one of them possesses John slightly, but then ends up being in Chiana, I think, eventually. And the other one possesses Pilot. And there are just a lot of shenanigans while they try to resolve this situation. There's, like, you know, like, who's sort of first figuring out that this is a problem, because at first they don't really realize it's a problem. And then, like, who's got the thing and how do we get rid of it? And eventually it's in Chiana, and the one in Pilot kills the one that was in Chiana, and then they realize that the one in Pilot is, like, evil and was pretending to be, like, nice to them. So they work directly with Moya to redirect some of the Starburst energy into the Pilot's den, which, like, zaps it dead. And then the B plot is Scorpius is interfacing with the neural chip that he took from John, and also overseeing tests of a wormhole spacecraft some modifications to a prowler that they're doing, and people die because they have not fixed it. People die because they have not successfully made a wormhole-proof prowler. And we get the reveal that Scorpius is under a lot of pressure to produce wormhole weapons because the Peacekeepers have been bluffing the Scarrans, basically, that they have these, like, nuclear-level wormhole weapons, and the Scarrans are starting to suspect that, hey, maybe they don't. Did I miss anything?
I think that covers most of it.
Yeah.
This is definitely a lighter episode than we've had in a long time.
Mm-hmm. I kind of don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, I think that might be part of the reason I like it, is that, although there are, when I was reading reviews and stuff about it, people reacted sort of differently to it being a little bit different than we've had so far.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it definitely feels like, oh, we've had this really heavy kind of death-centric, drama-centric, you know, failure-centric, psychosexual kind of romp for the last 8 episodes. And this feels, in a lot of ways, like a bit of a throwback.
Yeah.
It kind of is like a lower stakes A Bug's Life.
Yeah.
And I don't say that to degrade it. I think I hadn't really thought of it like another Bug's Life until I watched it this time.
Yeah.
And I didn't see anybody commenting like, oh, didn't they already do this in A Bug's Life? But there are definitely similar elements. But I think the kind of dynamic, too, that's here between the crew on Moya is that's one of the things I want to talk about, is I really dig the Dargo, John, Jewel, Chianna vibe.
Yeah, that's a good vibe.
They are very, like, silly goofball gang.
Yeah.
In a way that I enjoy. But there's also something new that happens in this one. I think we might as well tackle the B-plot first, because the B-plot and A-plot, as I've said, are entirely separate.
Uh-huh.
Where we have a story about Scorpius, and we really haven't ever seen that before.
Yeah.
Where he's... Actually, he begins the episode. That's one of the misdirects, right? Is that you right. think it's John having this dream about finding a wormhole on Moya, but it's actually Scorpius's dream about finding John finding a wormhole on Moya. In a very abstract, I think, Dramamine vision, like,
yeah,
strangeness at the beginning. So this is the first time that we've seen Scorpius since the end of Season of Death, where we find out that he didn't die, actually. And find out that he has... I kind of like that there is this, like, interpretation that he got the stuff out of John's brain and he has been putting it to use. That it's,
yeah.
They didn't put a pause on that plot line. It just propelled. What do you think about choosing to focus some plot on Scorpius? Just generally.
I think generally I like it. I think I might like it more if it were more tightly linked back to the Moya crew. So if it were, we have like an episode where we're seeing Scorpius in parallel and then he finds the team at the end.
Mm.
That I think would work a little better than just like, hey, care about Scorpius now.
Well, do you think they're trying to do care about Scorpius now or plot setup?
It's I think probably more plot setup. And that to me feels like a little clunky maybe. Because we haven't really seen, I think, like a peek inside the quote-unquote villain's ship without our protagonists.
Right.
Probably. I mean, I think they did it with Krace a little bit at the end of the first season, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, yeah, but that was when there was a relation. I mean, we saw Scorpius kind of chasing them too in Mind the Baby, but it was when it was while they were like hiding.
Yeah, it was
running and stuff. It was about the villain searching for them in some way. And I think the only time we ever saw Krace on his ship without the crew being nearby was in that old Black Magic, but it was about his interaction with John, and that was just sort of his side of the story. So this is, yeah, the first time we've seen, you know, a Peacekeeper story outside of a connection with, an immediate connection with the Moya group.
Yeah. That's unusual.
Yeah, I think it might have something to do with setting some stuff up that is going to be part of the rest of the season. There is an episode coming up in two, the next Moya episode, or the next not Talon episode, has a lot to do with Scorpius. I think there's also something to do with the fact that we haven't seen Harvey since Different Destinations, and Wayne Pygram is in the main cast.
Right.
So I think there's a sense of, like, wanting him to be part of the show.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we really haven't had Harvey stuff going on.
Yeah.
And I think it is interesting because the sort of... Well, you know what? Let me go ahead and play the clip of Bracken Scorpy talking about kind of the strategies that the Peacekeepers are employing.
Why do they give us so much rain? Chasing Crichton, researching wormholes.
Well, like you said, sir, I don't question High Command.
Would it surprise you to learn that the Scarrans are planning a massive assault against us, but they haven't? Because they fear our hidden wormhole weapons.
We have no hidden weapons.
We lied. And I think the Scarrans are beginning to suspect that. High Command reports that they've been massing armies. By latest estimates, Scarran warriors outnumber Peacekeeper soldiers 10 to 1.
But if and when they attack, we will lose Bracca.
Unless we harness a superior weapon.
Yes. Wormhole technology without it. The Sabbatian race will be overrun. Thousands of cycles of history gone. There's so little time. Sometimes I feel it is already inevitable.
Yeah, I'm skipping around a little bit. But I do think that the whole idea of focusing on Scorpius is a pretty big diversion from how Farscape usually does things, because we've almost exclusively in this series had big sweeping narratives, yeah, but it's always been about relatively few characters and mostly related to their fears and well-being and hopes and etc.
Yeah.
But this is the first time a larger political narrative is getting integrated into the plot.
Uh-huh.
And it's sort of interesting that it's initiated by a major character, but not one of the Moya gang.
Yeah.
That it is Scorpius being like, hey, because this, I don't think it's, again, a spoiler to really say that the things he's talking about in this episode really play out in one way or another over the course of the rest of the series. Peacekeeper Scarran stuff is a big theme.
Yes.
And influences things about how the folks on Moya do stuff in the future.
Yeah.
And it makes sense in some ways for it to be Scorpius introducing it, but it is slightly unusual that it's pulling away from what we're used to.
Well, I think it is and it isn't, because like we have had little bits and pieces of this setup. We had the Scarran in Look at the Princess. And...
Right. I'm not saying it's coming out of the blue.
Right.
I'm just saying that this is something that at the moment that it is introduced, John Crichton and his buddies do not have any vested interest or care about it and are basically not knowledgeable other than, oh, Scarrans and Sabbatians are, you know, fucked.
Not pals.
Mm-hmm. And we're not fans of either of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I also really love that scene because I love all scenes with Bracca. I just adore him. And, like, he's clearly so happy. So the clip started right after Scorpius asked, do you know why you're my second in command? And they, like, go through a bit that sets up the conversation that they had. And, like, I have a note about how Bracca looks like he's about to jizz in his pants. When Scorpius asks him that question, like, he's like, oh, my God. Scorpius wants to talk to me about me.
Yeah, this is definitely one of the those scenes that gives credence to the Bracca-Scorpius narrative. In fact, in Marcus Scherer's review, he describes this scene as strangely intimate. And he says it's intimate because Bracca is present when Scorpius admits that he's failing. And when he's doing these sort of, like, medical stuff to him, that's something you can kind of hear in the background of this clip, is that he's injecting himself with a bunch of stuff. And Bracca seems as excited to be, like, admitted to the inner sanctum of Scorpius's trust as anything else.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure Scorpius just wants somebody to, soliloquy at.
Yeah.
Which I guess makes it not a soliloquy. Monologue at. Whatever.
Good enough.
But is it interesting? Because we have talked before about what Scorpius's motivations are, right?
Yeah.
And that it is interesting because he is put in this position of, like, oh, this is a genuine, like, problem that I can imagine peacekeepers would feel really threatened by.
Yeah.
And be extremely invested in, you know, Cold War style, nuclear deterrence kind of situation.
Uh-huh.
And I think it does not too tidily wrap up a lot of stuff about, like, why does he have all this power and special leeway, and it's because there's a significant amount of pressure riding on the idea that this is what could save peacekeepers. The other interesting thing about this conversation is that does he refer to the Sabbatian race as we?
Maybe.
I'm looking at a transcript and it doesn't say we, but I feel like that's something I'd heard in the clip itself. But it's definitely interesting that he's fully siding with Sabbatian race mm-hmm. and history yes. in this. And looking at the Scaran invasion or whatever you want to call it as, like, a complete and total obliteration of Sabbatian history.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting scene for a few reasons, and we'll see more of this play out over the third season and beyond. But
I'm just really struck by what an important conversation that is for the mm-hmm. context of the series, and how I tend to tune out after a little bit when, like, Scorpius and Bracca are talking. And so, like, I'm wondering if I somehow never saw that conversation because it sounded so fresh and new to me.
Hmm. I don't know.
But probably it's just that I wasn't paying attention closely enough. Probably.
I think this is an easy one to kind of phase out of because it isn't something we're used to seeing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it is this kind of different talk about, like, the upper level politics and factions of all of this, but the way that gets integrated and kind of pulled down and woven in through interpersonal stuff and, like, you know, affecting characters we do care about is I feel like this scene, parts of it, get played as a previously on for, like, a dozen episodes in the future, because it's the most efficient, like, kind of setting up of what the political situation is between Scarans and peacekeepers for a while.
Yeah.
Jumping back to some earlier stuff in this scene, I had forgotten how quickly and early on this story starts. What is it a story about? What are we talking about? Is it
wormholes?
Why, yes, it is wormholes.
Yes.
Thank you, Nikita. I gotta remember to use that clip more because we're going deep into wormhole territory with Moya John.
I love Scorpius. That clip. I actually did that when the show, when it starts and, you know, it's Scorpius and John and the worm and then the dream sequence. I literally was like, wormholes at the screen.
Wormholes. So I had forgotten how early the Scorpy wormholes stuff had begun. And how early we meet this little crew that he's assembled of researchers who, this is not the last time we see them. They are the only guest cast in this episode. And do you want to know who's in the rogues gallery of this guest cast?
Yes.
This is fun. Okay, so the non-Sebastian male scientist, Streppa, who we will see in a few more episodes. Do you know who that is?
No.
That's Danny Adcock, who played Treltix in Crackers Don't Matter.
Oh my god.
I told you he was going to come back, and here he is. Interestingly, I found out it's not in IMDb, but the like the fun facts on the DVD says that he also played the slave trader who Dargo talks to in Liars, Guns, and Money about getting the his son back.
Huh.
Remember the guy that they call and he's like, we've already sold them. That's Danny Adcock too. Which is just, whoa, okay. Fun. So, yeah, Streppa is that guy. The lady scientist is named Lynn Fur. Do you know who she is? We have also seen her before.
She kind of reminded me of the lady from Thank God It's Friday Again, but that might only have been because they were both kind of white.
Ah, no. I don't think you would guess. It is going to... I'm excited to see you react to this information. That is the same woman who played Rorg of Rorf and Rorg fame.
No.
Your face is doing all the things I thought it would. I'm very excited.
Sometimes I feel a lot of pressure when you say, I can't wait to see how you're going to react to this, and I worry about underperforming, so I'm glad that I delivered.
Good job. Yeah, so that's her.
Dang.
And then the other guy, the other scientist who they, like, execute by putting him in the Prowler is Ian Bliss, who apparently was in a bunch of Matrix movies or something. I didn't really recognize him from anything, but he's been in a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
But this is his only role on Farscape. I have to shout out, though, that the actor who is the initial pilot who gets into the Prowler and turns to goo is an actor with one of the best names I've ever heard in my life.
Okay.
And that is Tux Akindayeni.
That's beautiful.
It's a great name.
That's T-U-X a beautiful name.
T-U-X is his first name. Tux.
Oh my god.
Hi, I'm Tux. Tux Akindayeni. Like, what?
It's good. It's really good.
Anyway, so a fun little science team that he's assembled.
What do we think about the fact that the science team... that is a peacekeeper science team, has so many non-Sebastians on it?
I think that is a very good point. And I think that it would probably not look like that if Scorpius were not in charge.
I have to wonder, I mean, yes, that's true. I have to wonder how much of it is showing that, like, Scorpius values scientific whatever and plays by his own rules, and how much is just... we're a space show, so we need to have aliens who look like aliens.
There's probably some of that, but I'm sure at the same time that they thought about, like, about, oh, would they only have Sebastians involved?
Right.
I mean, we've seen that peacekeepers are super willing to use other species on a sort of, like, contract basis.
Yeah.
You know, Zalix has contracted these monster aliens to help her out. Scorpius is there because he's very smart.
Yes.
We've seen, you know, implications in, like, Nerve and Hidden Memory that, like, peacekeepers keep non-Sebastian staff or, you know, play sugar daddy to some non-Sebastians. Like, I think it's almost a good sign of, like, the hypocrisy of the idea of, you know, eugenic racial superiority,
right?
Is that, yeah, y'all say that you're the best, but you are definitely hiring outside talent.
Right.
Skilled outside talent.
Good point. Good rebuttal.
It's not really a rebuttal. I think it is a very good point. And I'm wondering if it does get mentioned at any point in the future. I mean, it is cheaper to not put them in all that makeup, so.
That's legit.
It would have been much easier to just be like, oh, he has a Sebastian scientist team. But what you gonna do? So what happens in this plotline is that they've found a way to kind of generate wormholes from John's brain information. They send a pilot. There's some deliberation about whether or not it's ready for Sebastian trials. They've successfully sent in unmanned vehicles and brought them back. The Sebastian scientist is very insistent that they're ready. They send in poor Tuxican to Yenny. And he gets turned to goo. Holy shit, more goo on Farscape.
Yeah.
And then Scorpius reacts to this by sentencing the project leader, the Sebastian, to death by making him fly into it. And making Strepa the project leader. Do you think that's a Scorpius thing to do? To just be like, oh, you failed. Guess you're dead now.
I think it's less about you failed, you're dead now, and more about you put your direct report in danger, and you were confident in yourself when you shouldn't have been, and you're not doing a good job taking care of my resources that I'm giving you. So you have to experience what he experiences. That feels like a particularly Scorpius kind of cruelty to me.
I guess the thing that I push against is the idea that presumably this guy was intelligent and good at what he did enough to make Scorpius's project leader. And it seems very un-Scorpius-like to me to sacrifice that knowledge and talent.
Yeah.
For that reason. See a punishment, but like fully just like cutting the cord and being like, you're dumb, bud. You're losing a lot. Now, maybe that's worth it to Scorpius. Maybe that guy is there, even though Scorpius doesn't want him to be for some other political reasons or something. But yeah. That's not made clear. Scorpius is just like, you've disappointed me. I shall now execute you. And to me, that rang a little bit like Scorpius is so practical that it seems unlikely that he would kill somebody who could help him.
Yeah. Even by being severely demoted and working in the kitchen or whatever.
Yeah. And even if you go back to the pilot he sacrificed in Season of Death, that was very much like sacrificing, you know, a lesser chess piece to save himself.
Yes.
Whereas he's not gaining anything from this other than, like, a reputation for being fucking cruel, which doesn't really make the project work better because it's not about, like, fear of reprisal that's going to make a breakthrough on this.
Yeah.
So it's just, I don't know. I felt like it was a slightly weird choice, but
I feel like it was a slightly weird choice on that guy's part to go from unmanned to Sebastians without stopping for, like, a canine or a monkey in the middle. Because that would have solved a lot of problems.
Yeah. There's this interesting thing, too, that I can't remember exactly how this plays out from Scorpius' side, but this idea that, like, I can't remember if he's convinced now or he's saying it seems apparent or what, but the idea that Sebastians can't travel in wormholes and John can, but we know that that's not true because Aaron has.
Right.
And, like, everybody on Moya has. Like, and in Moya's transport pods, too. Like, that's the thing. Although maybe the ancients were, like, I don't know. I guess it depends on what you think the wormhole the ancients made actually was.
Yeah.
But I guess Moya got stuck in a wormhole. Or the wall of the wormhole? I don't know.
The wall
of
the wormhole.
This is all way too deep in the weeds for what we need to be talking about, but there's at least the seed of this idea that, like, maybe there's a genetic difference, but I think it doesn't necessarily play out that way.
No.
Anyway, moving along. Do you have anything else to say about this plot line before we move to the main story?
Scorpius injecting himself was new, right? We haven't seen that before. We've only seen the cooling rods.
I think that's right, yeah. Definitely not something I'm like, oh yes, Scorpius and his injections.
Right.
I mean, there may have been something at some point, but I don't really remember.
I don't remember. I'm like, this isn't Scorpius's normal weird medical thing.
All right, if that wraps everything up with Scorpius and his wormholes, let's move on to talking about the Moya gang. I've already said I really like the dynamic that's here.
Mm-hmm.
I like the goof-em-ups. I like a lighter, humorous Farscape in at least in some dosages.
Relatively speaking, a person mm-hmm. did get liquefied in this episode.
Yeah, but that was like Scorpius's sitch.
Right, a person who doesn't matter.
Yeah. But we are seeing this setup very distinctly, very immediately between what Talonjon is like and what Moyajon is like. I have a clip.
Pilot, can we keep going?
We can do anything if the others want to, but...
Well, then can we turn around? I am sick of running to the ends of the fecic just because he's got a belly in his butt.
I have explained this to you.
You have explained it to all of us.
Over and over and over.
The deep space variances we encountered indicate that
we could be somewhere near a wormhole.
The variances could also indicate a trillion other possibilities, none of which have anything to do with wormholes.
Guys, I know that you have been patient.
Oh. Not more. I have had it up to Parsec's bow.
No, yeah, come on, Gianna, don't.
Pilot,
don't.
Get us out of here.
Don't. Look. Remember the ship in the wormhole? I saw the Three Stooges, the broadcast.
I'm with Miss Monochrome. Let's just get the frill out of here.
Dee, come on, man. Look, it's the Stooges. I gotta, look, you know, it's Earth, it's home. I know I'm a little obsessive, but I gotta.
John, we have been searching for 10 solar days. I mean, come on, enough is enough. You saw that broadcast through a wormhole, and you know as well as I do, your home could be anywhere.
The little passive-aggressive at the end of that is the most John thing ever.
My favorite part of that scene is Jewel being unimpressed with John's scientific chops. I think that's an influence that's really been missing from his life in space, and I'm happy that it's found him.
Yeah, Jewel being there to check him a little bit is really nice. I'm happy about it. Yeah, it is funny that he kind of goes from person to person, like, come on! Do this thing for me.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and like Dargo is his last resort. And he keeps being like, it's the Stooges. Dargo's just like, dude, I've been doing this for 10 days. Come on.
Also, I don't know who the Stooges are.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Just a little thing. Do you know what I realized right before you played this clip, which was why I was making the face that I was making?
Oh, what is that?
John has never been lost in space without Aaron.
Yeah.
And with what Talonjon said to her last week about being his constant, being the thing he orients himself to,
yeah,
I think he's really finding himself at a loss just because this person who he's come to rely on so much is not there, is completely incommunicado. He doesn't know if she's okay, but he also can't, like, rely on her to help him modulate his feelings.
Yeah, I think that is an excellently observed point. And these two episodes really set up very clearly that Moyajon and Talonjon kind of take the two paths available to John, right, is this wormhole pursuit and this Aaron pursuit, and Talonjon is the Aaron John and Moyajon is the wormhole John, and that the wormhole centering really only can happen in the absence of Aaron, because there is an inherent conflict in, like, keeping Aaron and wormholes. I think Talonjon, you know, his wormhole situation is, like, non-existent right now. And Moyajon's Aaron situation is non-existent. So I think both of them definitely are trying to steady themselves and find stuff to cling to in this still difficult environment in which they live. And, yeah, we've got this laid out now. We've got this mapped for us. And we will see how it continues.
That is so well observed. That was beautiful.
So John gets visited by this alien and levitated.
Yes.
And loses time and bleeds.
And then can't find a wound from which he bled.
Yes. And is freaking out about it, understandably. And so apparently the bleeding that he does is Ben famously got a really terrible nosebleed during his audition.
Oh.
For this role, and he did not notice it. And everybody, like, doing the audition was like, are you okay? And he was like, yeah, I'm fine. Why? And he had, like, blood pouring out of his face, and he had no idea. So this is apparently a reference to that. Just the strangest fucking reference of all time.
That's a really funny inside joke that they put on the outside.
Yeah. But it does definitely lend a, like, unsettling air to the whole thing.
Yeah. And it's never explained.
Yeah, that's actually a point I was going to bring up from the Oshiro review. I was looking at Alistair Wilkins' review and Mark Oshiro's, and Alistair was sort of on the side of that in sort of the same thinking I was about this being like a kind of a breath of fresh air, but and it works as a kind of counterweight to the more emotionally complex stories that we've been getting. Mm-hmm. But Mark Oshiro was saying, like, oh, it kind of actually suffers from the placement because there is such a massive and ridiculous and terrifying importance to them, and this one feels disconnected and, like, untethered to things. And he says that part of the thing that, like, contributed to that for him was that this stuff was not really explained. You don't know why anybody floats. You don't know why anybody loses time. Like, that's not explained. You don't know why John bled. It really, like, there's a lot of setup in this first act that doesn't really have the promises delivered on by the end of the episode.
Yep.
It's a little bit like you get a really good horror movie kind of beginning, and then you find out it's something kind of mundane.
It's like a mini encapsulation of everything J.J. Abrams has ever done.
And it did it first.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that really kind of puts a finger on why I am so, like, about this episode.
Mm.
And it is the lack of follow through. And also that, like, the energy monsters are stupid. They are a stupid villain, and they get on the ship in a stupid way, and they do stupid things, and it's dumb.
Would you like to say more on that subject?
No.
That okay.
Covers it. That covers it. They're
okay.
They're not. It fundamentally does not make sense from a scientific perspective.
Do I need to play a jingle?
No, because I don't really even know enough about space to be able to back up my assertions that it's bullshit. I just okay. feel very strongly that it's bullshit, and that's enough to make a fact.
Gotcha. That's a fascinating line of thinking you've taken there. I did have the point that John has all these things happen, and then nobody believes him, and he doesn't really have good evidence of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of freaking out because he's already in this weird state. And it is interesting that both Crichtons in the first stories that they have separated from each other are kind of being gaslit. Like, Talon is definitely gaslighting John, and then John is sort of getting gaslit by the... I don't know that means anything. It's just kind of an odd coincidence.
The Energy Riders.
Yeah, the Energy Riders are kind of...
That's such a stupid name.
Like, both of them are very concerned about stuff that may or may not actually be happening.
Yeah, that there, it is hard to know what reality is.
Mm-hmm. But John is very persistent about, like, figuring this out, even though nobody believes him. And there, again, a lot of good lines in here.
Yes.
Where he goes to Chiana and he's like, Am I bleeding? And she kind of teases him and then slaps him. And he's like, I was a lake of blood. It was biblical. And he's like, and everybody's just like, you need to sleep. You need to, like, calm down. And he keeps asking Pilot for all this evidence and all this stuff. And, like, Chiana's even like, you smell bad. Like, it's so clear that he hasn't been taking care of himself in any way, shape, or form. Oh, he's, like, a dude who just got divorced and moved into a shitty apartment and doesn't know how to, like, brush his teeth in the morning. Like, that's so clearly what's going on.
I'm so sad about it.
Yeah. I do like that he uses furthering the idea that DRDs are Roombas before Roombas existed. DRDs clean up the blood.
Yeah.
And he's, like, trying to find the blood in the DRD. So that's the thing, is, like, where did the blood go if he did bleed? Like, we don't even know at the end of the thing if, like, yeah, what exactly happened there? That's another thing we don't super know. I'm not that concerned about those particulars. Like,
yeah.
I enjoy watching this episode for reasons that are not the consistency and the payoff of that mystery.
Right.
Because I often, when I'm, like, watching a mystery, I kind of lose track of what it is in the middle.
Yeah.
So I don't really care if it doesn't all
add up by the end. Yeah.
I do like the idea that's sort of presented here, though, I think by Pilot, where he's like, well, maybe the duplication process is a part of this. You know, is an explanation for this. And that in a very nice callback, Chiana's like, fuck no, it's not. It has nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
Again, a very subtle but very well-observed little callback to how sensitive she might be about that.
Yeah, I didn't catch that. That's good. Good catch.
I do want to take a minute while we're in this part of the episode to just step back and say a word or two about Tammy McIntosh's goddamn abs. Like,
I have a note about, like, why is she so naked, but, like, on the other hand, can I be mad about it? No.
Do you like her new outfit?
Aesthetically, yes. I think she wears it very well, and I like the fashion of, like, the small shorts underneath the skirt with the slits.
Yeah.
Like, decorative fabric is a thing that I'm into generally. Like, I love a cape, and that's, like, basically a cape for her legs, and, like, I'm about it. From like, a critical viewership perspective, I'm like, that's really objectifying and gross, and I feel bad being a fan of it, but also, like, that's Jules' look, is, like, Xena space princess.
A little bit. And I mean, like, we get, if as far as gender equity goes, we get a lot of shots of Ben's butt in leather.
Yes, we do.
And very tight leather pants. Not that those are exactly equivalent, but, like,
right.
Yes, there is that. Tammy was a gymnast, I believe, is why she might look quite like that. And they probably were like, how do we show off what's happening here a little bit? Fascinatingly, there is a cut scene where Jewel walks in that outfit, having initially changed into it, in the room with Chiana, and Chiana's like, it's this very strange scene that has a particular kind of energy to it.
Is it a gay energy?
But Chiana's like, oh, is that what you think is sexy? And Jewel's like, what? It's hot. And Chiana's like, it would have to be a lot hotter than this for me to wear that. But then I think might also have patted her butt. Like, it's hard to tell. It's a weird moment, and it's a cut scene, so I'm not going to put a lot there, but, like, there was a lot of, like, Chiana looking at Jewel, like, with a degree of appreciation or astonishment.
The thing about that cut scene is that it kind of does make an explanation for why she's in the very revealing outfit, but then makes it worse by objectifying her more. It's like, you just keep escalating the same thing.
Yeah, it is a strange
scene.
But I'm not mad at the outfit. I like, it's a good slit on the skirt, two of them. It sort of reminds me of the dress that what the girl Rennick was wearing in Thanks for Sharing. Looks like maybe they painted it a different color and cut off the top half of it and slapped it on Tammy. but well done, Tammy. Good job having dem abs
and sharing them with all of us.
Where to go from there? Yeah, so John makes everybody, like, sit and watch him. Which, again, humorous.
Yes.
And then they find out that they all, like, in one of the more disturbing scenes we've seen lately,
yep,
everybody just, like, starts shaking and going into crazy lost time mode, and it's very upsetting. And again, we have no idea why this happened or why they don't remember, because they do remember later in the episode when it did happen. So I don't know, maybe there's, like, stealth mode tasting that's less effective than, like, full-on tasting. And Teleb was like, yeah, I could, once they know it doesn't matter, I don't fucking know.
It's too stupid for me to even engage with.
All right. So I like guess your that's the episode, everybody. Have a good night. Bye.
No,
I mean, I'm gonna clip that and make it the intro. It's too stupid to even engage with.
But then Justin Monjo's feelings will be hurt, which is not my intention.
Oh no. So what eventually happens is that we learn the pilot is possessed by this, like, cop? I don't know. Some kind of enforcement official, maybe.
So he says of these
energy riders, and he is investigating a runaway rider that is in one of them. And everybody's pretty unhappy about that, but there's not much they can do. And they start sort of cooperating with the one in pilot because they don't have much of a choice, and I guess at least that writer is being honest about taking over one of their bodies.
Yes.
The other one isn't. And so there's a lot of stuff, you know, along the lines of, like, oh, it won't know your personal information.
Yes.
Which gives us a few interesting scenes. We get a scene I thought you might enjoy, because we finally get an answer to a question you've been curious about for some time.
My dad's name was Jack. My dog's name was Hubble. I lost my virginity to Karen Shaw in the back of a 4x.
How old were you?
16.
I was 7.
Hubble.
Yes.
Which is a dog named after a space scientist. Yep. So I win that one.
Okay. You do win.
But he says my dog's name was, but he also says my dad's name was. So it's unclear if this is an extant dog or a previous dog.
Yeah.
But the dog mystery is coming together. More and more.
Well, and I was really invested in it. And you were like, this is stupid, Monica. Nobody cares about his fake dog. Yes, I do.
Well, he's never said anything about it before now. What do you think about that 7-year-old virginity losing joke?
I think Luxon biology is very different from human incubation biology. And the joke itself outside the universe of the show, within the context of Earth, is like kind of... I think...
I mostly think it's strange that because they so badly wanted to get that joke in, they have Dargo ask a bizarre question of how old were you when you lost your virginity, when that was, like, not a thing that he knew, and also not relevant to the proceedings.
Yeah, also, like, why would he even care?
Yeah.
Culturally, why does that matter?
Yeah. That puts a weird perspective Jothi's age situation that we were dealing.
Yeah, it kind of does. Like, okay, so Luxons really do just
mature
very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a retcon for, like, people who were concerned about how old Jothi was.
If that's what it was, I really don't hate it. But if it was just, like, a weird, gross patriarchy joke... enforcement mechanism?
I don't think it necessarily was, but I'm not that pressed about it. It's a slightly odd little aside that's definitely supposed to be funny, but, like, looking at it under even a slightly different lens, you're like, wait, what's happening here?
What's funny about this?
Okay. I guess that's cool. Thanks, Dargo. Thanks for that info, buddy. We get another Karen Shaw shout out though.
Yes, we do.
Which we first learned about Karen Shaw and John losing his virginity to her way back in 108. So
good callback.
We have more information about Karen Shaw than we do about John's dog.
Why do you do this to me?
I think you know the answer.
That's fair.
I also enjoy when they go to confront Chiana about the what she knows about her life.
Yeah.
And they are suspicious of her, and she obviously does have the writer in her. But then I feel the good with the Neary that Dargo does is also delicious.
Yes.
And I do like the callback to, like, her saying that the guy, you don't even know if I killed that guy or not, so, like, yeah. It's not actually a good question for you to ask me.
Yeah.
We also never learned how the energy writer, like, figured this out about her, like, or if this was some bullshit that Taleb did, like, again, you're just shrugging and making a face that tells me everything I need to know.
Yeah. I regret that I cannot render the face in words.
Yes, that is often true. But after that, we do learn some interesting new truths about our friend Jewel.
Yeah, we do.
I discovered a Noatian gem mine. The guards caught me. They sold me to Grunchlick. End of pathetic story.
And what about your cousins? How'd they get frozen?
They waited in the village for me. They got sick, and...
That is not what you told us before.
I was lying before!
Yeah, I do like that we're getting a little more shading to Jewel. I think she's really good in this episode. I like her characterization. I think it's honing in a little bit better.
Yeah.
And I like that we're learning that she isn't necessarily this super privileged, overeducated princess. She was actually kind of a privateer of some kind. We get more information on this later, but...
Okay.
This is the first... I admire the way that Farscape... I can never tell if it's, like, retconning a storyline it doesn't like by saying somebody lied about it, but I also don't mind because... Right. It, like, people lie. That's, like, a thing that happens.
Yeah.
And... It makes sense for her to have lied to some strangers that she didn't know about what exactly was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense that Grunchlick would have lied about, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So.
And I think especially a lie like that can be strategic because she's encouraging people to underestimate her.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a confession to make, which is that I actually can't really understand very well what she's saying there because of the accent. She found a mine of some kind.
Yeah, she found a gem mine.
Oh, a gem mine.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a Noatian gem mine or an Oatian gem mine.
Okay.
Because Australian.
Right.
But yeah, she just said she discovered this gem mine that she wasn't, I guess, supposed to be in.
Right.
And she was apprehended and then sold to Grunchlick. And again, we don't have any information yet of, like, if she was almost dead when they did that, or Grunchlick just, like, took this fully alive person and put her in cryostasis.
Yeah.
Like, to sell her organs later, which is fucked up. I can't remember exactly how much more we learn about this, but, that's a pretty sad story. And then her cousins were sick, and yeah. I guess that's why they didn't survive, is that they already were sick.
Yeah.
But I guess that is the explanation we are getting so far about why she survived the defrosting and they did not. So the cop writer tastes her and it is a terrible experience and she freaks out. And, then he goes with Chiana down to this, like, space below the neural cluster, which is where Starburst generates. And the first thing I have to say about this is, the chamber props are very bunk. it's so clear those are just, like, LED string lights inside of some plastic tubing. Like, those things have, like, cycles of blinking, and they didn't even bother to change them. They're not even consistent on one thing. It looks... It's always bothered me. And I finally get to talk about it.
I actually didn't, like, really get that. I don't think I noticed how bad they were, and I actually kind of enjoyed them.
Oh, well, never mind.
Because it just... It's a cool room, generally, that they have, and yeah. I think... I just get so excited about the idea that they used a DRD to talk to Moya, and Moya led them down to this chamber where Pilot can't sense anything because it's inside the heart of her brain where Starburst comes from or whatever.
Inside the heart of her brain.
Yep.
That sounds like a song that would debut at Lilith Fair.
Thank you.
Yep. So, yeah, I like the Star Trek communication blinking system business. I like it when the crew interacts with Moya. I think that's fun.
Yeah.
I like that the writers, like, don't forget about that when Pilot's sort of out of commission. That, like, there's this other entity there that you can try and communicate with.
Yeah.
Via the DRDs. Although, I guess Moya has, like, a telepathic link with all the DRDs. Like, I do not understand exactly how that relationship works. But it was entertaining to watch.
Sorry, I'm thinking too hard about
it. Yeah, I can tell. You have a thinking face on, and I'm trying to give you that time, but also...
Move it along.
Move it along.
Let's move it along.
So, in the Starburst chamber, which I'm not saying it looks terrible. It's really just the fact that it's so clearly, like, I don't know, have you ever seen where people make, like a lamp cover, but then just stick a string of LEDs in it, and you can see, like, where they all are. It just looked like that to me so much, and I was just like, all right. So it's in this chamber that we not only discover that there's some... technique that will be used later in the episode to get rid of the writer, but we also see that Chiana is infested with the rogue writer who takes over her body and communication for a minute, and you're making a face.
Gigi's really good in this scene, and I'm so uncomfortable
with
the whole thing.
She, if I can quote again, I believe, Alistair Wilkins' review, he writes that it's a really good showcase for Gigi, who somehow manages to play a massively more alien and massively more sexualized version of her already pretty damn alien and sexualized character without the whole thing collapsing into self-parody.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very good way to describe it.
Yeah.
And she, the writer, I guess, in Chiana, has some fun with John, and a lot of talk about tight bodies ensues, and apparently the writer has an ability to produce some pretty good feelings in John, and he has some interesting reactions to them.
Good God! Whoa, what did you just do to me?
Sip. Inspire. Talib is pain, not me.
Okay, that's good. But it doesn't prove anything.
Won't hurt your friend. Just must hide. Get me away. To where there are many. Talib not fine if there are many. Please.
Fine, I'll talk to my friends. You're gonna stay here. You're safe here.
Yo, how I know? Trust you.
You don't. But oh my god, I'll probably be back in 15 minutes. That's unnatural. Good god.
have some weird feelings about that scene, but Ben walking away at the end,
the yelling, waddle, good God, is really good. Really good.
Saves it. I think that happening at the end leaves me with just enough of a good feeling about it to enjoy it overall.
Yeah, it's real rapey.
It's a lot.
That sure is a sexual assault that happens.
I don't know if the writer has a concept of that, but okay.
Probably not.
Probably not. Something that, again, I'm sort of reminded of in this scene and a few others throughout the episode is that there's something going on in this that I kind of noticed and that a couple other people kind of noticed. And I think it was, again, Alistair Wilkins who called it a laddish atmosphere. And I think that's a very good way of describing it. Of like, there's a lot of dude kind of fun and funniness and like centric stuff in this, and like Chana and Jewel are a little bit pushovers,
yeah,
in ways that Aaron and Zan maybe weren't so much. Like, I can't imagine what the story would look like if Aaron and Zan were in it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it'd be very different.
Not that those two aren't characters who can kind of do this, but I think Chiana is so sidelined by the writer being in her basically the entire episode.
Right.
And Jewel is sort of still getting on her feet with these other people.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there's nothing about this that isn't played for basically strict laughs.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something about, like, I get that it has these kind of assaulty overtones, but I think it is, like, this writer is like a energy being that yeah. has no real, like, I think this is the equivalent of like pushing on a goldfish's brain and it like feeling a pleasure yeah. center thing is kind of what it's doing.
Yeah.
I don't think it has a sense of consent or sex. It's just like, oh, beings like this, right? You know, with brains and spinal yeah. columns, enjoy this thing. Vertebrates.
Yeah.
You know, John isn't overpowered in this moment. I think we learn later that the writer in Chiana's body could overpower him if it
right.
was so inclined. And John's mostly just like, all right, I gotta, this is overwhelming. I'm just gonna walk away from it. Because he knows it's not Chiana's fault, and he doesn't yeah. obviously want to do anything inappropriate to Chiana.
Right.
So he walks away from it. So I think, like, some of the ookiness of this can be kind of, it, like, it's still, it's not that it's not there, it's just, like, in the yeah. context of this, it's slightly less ooky than, I don't know, I'm yeah. originally.
I think it's much less, I think I'm less ooked out by it in universe than I am, like, in the context of culture on Earth now, contemporarily, that
okay.
that we have a mythology that, like, men can't be sexually assaulted, and then something like this, I think, really reinforces that. And it's, like, one of those things that I think a lot of people can look past, and I salute those who can, but I just gotta be a buzzkill.
Hmm.
Buzzkill gotta buzzkill.
Yeah. I mean, and I think there's something here about the show being like, oh, wouldn't this be fun? Like, they wrote right. this scene.
Yeah.
They showed the scene, and they used shots from the scene in the promo to make it look like the two of them were getting together or something. Yeah. It's sort of weird. So John leaves the writer to its own devices, but goes to... it's interesting because he consults with Moya about like what Moya wants him to do, and Moya kind of gives him directions on who to tell and what to tell them and yeah. stuff like that. And he does go tell Jewel and Dargo that the writer's in Chiana, and Jewel is so shaken by the experience that she has that she goes to, like, hold Chiana up
yeah,
and shoot her, which is, like, pretty serious. But again, the Chiana writer, like, cooperates even after dropping the act that it's not Chiana.
Yeah.
Again, another good line, though, is where Jewel is freaking out, and she's like, you're the one! And Chiana, still with the guys up, is like, okay, I'm the one! Like, it's really funny.
Yeah.
But then things go bad pretty quickly, and she finally does kind of snap and is violent towards John and Jewel. And then we find out that Teleb is now in control enough to, like, zap the writer, and zaps the writer out of Chiana, which is, again, a very terrifying scene involving levitation and a lot of, like, screaming and shaking, and again, we do not know why this is happening.
Yep.
But, of course, once the writer and pilot kills the writer and Chiana, the writer and pilot decides that it is perfect to stay too long, and now they have to get that out of pilot.
Yeah, but being pilot is really fun, and he doesn't want to stop.
Yeah. That's the real consent issue of this episode, I think.
Oh, yeah, body snatching probably triumphs over the other thing.
What do you think about them? I mean, do you remember the first time you watched this, or even watching it now, or any general thoughts about liking or disliking or thinking anything about the fact that both of these actors are not really great in this episode, and the sort of morality stuff of Moya crew getting involved? Because I know you like to talk about that.
I do like to talk about that. It's an interesting dilemma. I think in the end we find out that the one in Chiana was telling the truth about Teleb, right? That Teleb is bad.
Well, I mean bad in the sense that, like, it wouldn't leave pilot, I guess.
Right. But we don't really know whether it was telling the truth about, like, wanting to kill the one that was in Chiana.
Yeah, we have no objective, like, truth about, we just have the word of these two creatures.
Both of whom are now dead.
So we like, the writer in Chiana is never, like, exonerated.
Right.
But we have evidence. Yeah, we have evidence that both of them were not doing good things. Yeah. But
I think it's really interesting that John decides to trust the one that's in Chiana. I don't know that I really have a whole lot more to say about that.
He is very much like a hear both sides kind of guy in these situations of, like, all right, you stay here, I'm going to talk to you for a while, then I'm going to talk to the other one, and then I'm going to decide who's in the better position.
I guess it's nice to see a John being this, like, measured and rational about a problem that may even be a life-threatening problem, as opposed to how sort of out of control he's been lately. There seems to be a lack of aggro swagger here.
Yeah, he's definitely much more deliberate and measured and, like, wanting time to figure things out.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. And that is a little bit different than what we've seen from him before. And I think it's in part because the stakes are a little bit lower here. Like, they're not good, but it's not like anybody's going to get blown up immediately. It's right. Like, you know, Moya's not, like, dying without pilot, or pilot's not dying. It's just like, okay, we gotta figure out this problem, and the most efficient way to do it is to talk. And nothing bad is gonna happen if we spend some time talking instead of
Shooting people,
exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there is a bunch of back and forth, but of course, that doesn't work because it's Farscape.
Right.
And both entities are not exactly good.
Right.
In the end. But they have a plan for how to handle the one that stays in pilot. And that is to scare him out and then zap him with electricity from the Starburst chamber while he's in the air. And also, bafflingly, John has the sleepy, crippled friend, Chiana.
Do the crucial thing.
Do the not only the crucial thing, but the dangerous thing.
Yeah.
And what makes it even crazier is that he has a DRD do the exact same thing in a slightly different place. So a DRD could, like, two DRDs could have done it.
Right.
But no, he has, again, his sleepy, crippled friend who can't walk. And when she tells him, there's a point where he asks her, can you walk? And she says no. And he's like, ah, come on. And it's like, dude.
Yeah.
She can't walk. That's not, like, her fault, Rain.
Right, like, homegirl was just possessed for, like, a minute.
If you need her to be doing something, maybe make it the thing where she doesn't have to walk, which could have easily been going with Dargo instead of Jewel, or with Jewel instead of Dargo, and then have somebody with, like, a capable body go do the other thing. I mean, it's obviously there for the dramatics, but it's a baffling choice by the character.
And it's stupid dramatics.
Yeah.
Like, it's the end of the episode. Obviously, it's going to work. Do we really need this full minute of yelling?
Yeah.
Right? And then it's like, so then it's just over. They zap the thing. It works. We have, there's no explanations, there's no resolution.
Yeah, it's,
which is,
it really does, and I think the thing that annoys me most about it is this giant amount of electricity comes up through Pilot's den and zaps the writer as it is trying to transfer from Pilot to Moya, because they tricked it into believing that it had lost control of Moya's systems, and they just wanted, like, a ride to somewhere else. It's flying in the air, and it gets zapped and killed by the Starburst thing, but John and Pilot are just fine? Like, is Pilot's den, is the ground made of, like, rubber to insulate you from the, from the electroshocks?
It's because the thing is made of energy, so the energy just goes to where the energy is.
Yeah, that's slightly baffling.
Maybe, I don't know, ions.
And poor DRD Pike, gone before your time.
Honestly, the most upsetting part of this episode. I got really attached to that little critter.
Yeah. There's a lot of DRDs that get, like, made special briefly.
Yeah. John takes a liking to them.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the one he fixed in the pilot with a cute little broken antenna? That was a good one.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good DRD.
A very good DRD.
They're all good DRDs. DRDs are just dogs.
But yeah, then the episode, like we said, just kind of ends. Where, after the thing is zapped, everybody's safe and, like, tired.
Yes.
And they're all kind of, like, passed out. We do get a little, like,
a little hint of something.
Hint of something with Chiana, but not much. And John's still pushing the wormhole thing.
Obviously.
But nobody's super into that. And then we get another, like, Scorpius dream sequence. And we're out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it does wrap up pretty quickly.
Yeah, and it's sort of not a lot of things of consequence happen. And
I mean, there's, like, one thing of extreme consequence, which is the, like, whole, I mean, I guess it doesn't happen, but it is talked about in this episode, which is the whole wormhole Scorpius business. Yeah. But the Moya crew is definitely in, like, a one-off.
Right. They come out exactly the same as they started, just sleepier.
Yeah. And maybe with some psychic powers.
Right. And possibly a lower blood volume than at the start.
Yeah.
Maybe. We don't know.
Do you have any other notes about the episode? Gosh, we're really clipping through.
Yeah, well, it's...
There's not too much. There's not quite the level of psychosexual drama in this episode to really dive deep into, so it'd be a little shorter than
this. Yeah, yeah. Other notes. I watched this episode with my roommate, and she was very impressed by all the makeup and really seemed to enjoy it despite really having no idea what was going on. I kept pausing it to explain things to her, and then she was just like, never mind, there's too much. She really liked when John got Southern and said the thing about seven, like, a sheep in Arkansas.
Oh, I have a note about that, which is the first a million times I ever watched this, I did not catch it, but is that, like, a fucking sheep joke?
I actually don't know or remember because I only wrote down the punchline.
He says, shaking like a sheep in Arkansas.
I thought it was about tornadoes.
Tornadoes. I thought it was about heat the first bunch of times I listened to it. But I think it might actually supposed to be a joke about people in Arkansas like to have sex with sheep.
Okay. Sure.
Which, okay.
Yes. At the end of, toward the end of the episode, I have more Hannah commentary to share. So at the, toward the end of the episode, she referred to Crichton as Jason Bateman, as in Jason Bateman, he needs to relax, is what she said. And I found that entertaining.
Wait, so there's a spectrum of Scott Disick to Jason Bateman that Ben Browder is somewhere on.
Apparently.
According to people who sort of watch this TV show.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
now,
true.
Now I know what Jason Bateman looks like. I did not know what Scott Disick looked like. But yeah. I do know what Jason Bateman looks like. And I guess I they have similar hair.
Yes, I was going to
say.
And
are both white men of approximately the same size and coloring.
And emotional havingness occasionally.
But I don't know if I see it too much beyond that.
Yeah, no. Their faces don't look alike.
No.
I do think the dream sequences with Scorpius are really interesting. And I know we talked about this earlier and you were like, are you out of thoughts? And I was like, yes, but it turns out the answer was no.
It turns out there was a surprise, bitch.
Turns out.
Deal with it.
Yes. Surprise, bitch. He's interfacing with the neural chip there, right? He's got that machine and he's...
Oh, I always read it as a dream, but I think maybe you're right.
I read
maybe
it
that's
as...
something we I kind of wiped a lot of my memory of that stuff out, so maybe it's something we learn more about.
No, I read it as he's interfacing with the neural chip and the difficulty that he's had. I think what I took away from it was that he's gotten some of the wormhole knowledge, but not all of the wormhole knowledge. Yeah. And then with that last dream sequence at the end, he kind of gets the last little piece that he was looking for. And I think that is just interesting and cool, technologically speaking, and makes a lot more sense than trying to have a computer read it, because that wouldn't work.
Well, we will definitely get more elucidation about the chip and how Scorpius is using it and all that kind of stuff, so we can check in with that theory in the future. Are those all your notes?
No, I have no more notes.
Okay. I don't have too many extra ones. There are a lot of lines that I feel like I could just say from this episode. As kind of strange as the Chiana writer John sex party is, when he comes back and is saying, like, talking to her and is like, I'm not talking about the sex thing, that was great, but I'm not talking about it. Like, very funny. I also really enjoy Jewel hugging poor Chiana after the writer goes. I was like, aw, Jewel and Chiana doing hugs. See, they're starting to get along. They're starting to have that bond, which not too many ladies on this show have gotten to have.
Yeah.
So I really can't imagine Aaron or Zan doing quite that level of, like, cuddle.
Yeah.
I can see them doing a supportive, your head may rest in my lap while you are in the recovery position.
Right.
But that, like, warmth and affection.
Yeah.
Not quite. So it's nice to see a little bit of that.
Like, I'll hold your hand, but I'm just holding it. Like an object.
I'm holding it as I would an apple.
Basically.
Or a small vase. I think those are all my notes. I just, you know, I enjoy a little look at the B team. I think they're kind of the B team, the comedy team.
Yeah.
Having a little fun, learning a little bit about wormholes, you know?
Yeah.
This is all right.
Good
stuff.
I'm not
mad about it.
Yeah.
Do you have any science to yell about?
No. It's just all bad.
Monica yells about science. It's all bad. Because I'm a damn scientist.
Perfect.
All right. Beautiful. We'll fix it in post. moving on to 2001, A Hot Take Odyssey.
Yes, I want to hear the takes.
The takes. There were a few takes. I think I already mentioned a couple with regard to, like, everyone just being in full speculation mode about, like, now that Talon John is with Aaron, clearly Moya John has to choose somebody else. And they're like, Chiana would be a little bit weird, so maybe Jewel? Like, everybody was just, like, immediately obsessed with, like, who are they gonna make this dude bone? Like, 10 days later. They were like, yeah, after 10 days.
That totally makes sense to me, actually. Like, just having been in fandom spaces, like, that's the paradigm under which a lot of them operate. That's not surprising to me at all, and I only wish I could have been there. But sorry. I was too young.
I think my favorite hot take is that somebody was convinced that the writer laid eggs in Crichton when it went through the first time.
Love it.
They were like, so much speculation happening about, like, what if those eggs come to hatch?
Well, that's kind of the great thing about this show is that
that could happen.
Right. That really is a real possibility. And if it had happened, that person would have been like, boom, I'm a fucking prophet.
I think the award for most 2001 hot take is, so is this like the West Wing now? We get a previously on every week? Like, I just want to watch that person pass out at something like Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones.
Oh my god, like, I know! Television's changing.
Television is super changing. Oh, speaking of more rampant speculation, everybody's super, super interested in this part of the season about how the Two Johns thing is going to play out. And yeah, just, like, looking at theory after theory of, like, what's going to happen to Aaron John versus what's going to happen to Wormhole John. And especially once that dynamic is established. I've never seen as much speculation in the forums as there is right now about, like, how is this particular plot gonna resolve.
That just, like, makes me really happy in my soul, because I know that feeling of speculating and having fun with speculation, and I'm just happy that it happened, I guess.
Yeah. There was also significant love for Jewel's new duds. People were into it. I think somebody said, dude, I love that thing. It's like the freaking bronze bikini, but better. Yeah, so those are the 2001 hot takes. Maybe I'll do, like, a speculation of the week now that everybody's, like, super wild about it.
I like that. I would like to hear that.
It's a little tricky, though, because you know that everything I say is not what's actually going to happen.
Right. Right. So you automatically know that whatever you say is ruled out.
Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see if I find some, like, really funny ones.
Yeah.
Like, I've revealed, I'm so sorry that thing did not lay eggs in John.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let us see how the odds stack up against this episode and our final clips. Snip, 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 scissors. I feel like I know the answer from you. I feel like I don't even need to ask.
Can I keep the Scorpius stuff and leave the rest of it behind?
Like, I don't know.
That would be my ideal, but I think...
Yeah.
Push comes to shove, I would cut it, even though there is the wormhole stuff, because the rest of it is boring.
Yeah. I think we get some retreading of the wormhole stuff, and I think there's only a few ideas that you need to communicate
right
about the wormhole stuff to really get it, and those fit quite well into a previously on and may be reiterated in literally the next episode that focuses on not Talon. So I think we'll get a chance to see how well this fits in. I do like this episode, I think, more than I should, but I think it would have to get cut. It really does depend a little bit on, like, how the rest of some stuff plays out. I think for now, unless it receives some Phoenix-like resurrection, it's probably going to end up on the losing side of a 13-episode season.
Yeah.
We'll see, though. So, also, relatedly...
Ratings.
How would you rate this episode, Monica?
I'm thinking. This is my thinking face. Like, I can't just rate it, like, grimace emoji,
Like Grimace from McDonald Land?
No, like the emoji that looks like this. Just grimacing. Just.
I'm going to leave the entire pause in which you made the face in.
No. That will be so boring for the listeners.
Well, you brought it upon them. Listeners, blame Monica for that pause.
I'm going to come up with a better one. She does not
understand still, after more than a year, that this is an audio medium in which to convey your emotions and thoughts. You have to use your voice rather than your impressive but silent array of facial expressions.
I think I rate it 2 out of 2 bullshit energy monsters.
Cool. I think this one's a tricky one for me to rate because I like it in many ways better than episodes that are of higher quality.
I think that's allowed.
Yeah, it's one of those where I'm like, oh, this is the fun, dumb one. Like, this is just, like, nice to have.
Yeah.
Like, oh, right, they, like, do some dumb monster shit and say silly things and, like, it's Farscape for when you don't really want to think about what's happening.
Yeah.
So I think I'll put it for the moment maybe I kind of feel about it maybe similarly as I do Sons and Lovers, which probably puts it in like the 5 or 6 slot so far, which is not super high, but it'll get bumped higher as time goes on, I think.
Yes.
We'll see. Rest of the season impress me.
That was a good arm gesture that you did. But
yeah, but I use my words while I did it. That's the difference. Before we go bicker forever about how to communicate on our podcast, Monica, why don't you give us the socials and we will make a graceful exit.
Will we? Okay, if you would like to chat with us, you can find us on Twitter at FrellcastShow and reach us at frellcast@gmail.com. You can listen to us at soundcloud.com/frellcast, asterisk on the whole what's happening to SoundCloud, we still don't know, thing.
Yeah, I can't believe there have been no updates about that.
No updates. We're also on iTunes and in the Google Play location. And if you would like to give us money for coffee or other sundries, you can do that at
It's money for hosting fees. Let's make it clear. It is a direct support of the podcast doing its thing.
If you would like to support the important work that we do here.
The truly vital work of talking for fucking hours about Farscape, often 2 to 3 times in excess of the length of the episode. Please tell them where to give, Monica.
You can give at ko-fi.com/frellcast.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron, for a lovely evening, as always.
It's been a real success. I agree. All right. Well, everyone, I hope you have a good day, and we will talk to you next week about some mama drama.
Hey.
Bye.
We will all urinate together.